Welcome back, everyone. I am Cass Piancy, and I'm joined, as usual, by my partner in crime, Mr. Bennett Tomlin. How are you today?
I'm doing well, Cass. How are you?
I'm good. We have a great guest, a return guest, Rohan Gray. You have a million fantastic titles. I will, you know what I'll do is I'll record them after this. I'll re-record the whole thing. And true to my word, here I am, the embarrassed and unprepared co-host of Crypto Critics Corner, Cass Piancy, to say that Rohan Gray is the assistant professor of law at Willamette University, the research director of the Digital Fiat Currency Institute, a consultant to the UN International Telecommunication Union's focus group on digital currency, and helped author the eCash Act. It's wonderful to have you here, Rohan. How are you today?
Yeah, good. Thanks for having me. I mean, it's an exciting week, you know, in the realm of digital money. So
it is an exciting week, and we have you on specifically to talk about something quite exciting, which is the eCash bill that is being introduced that you helped work on.
Yeah, it's the Electronic Currency and Secure Hardware Act, which just perfectly spells eCash. So, you know, when you write enough bills, the acronym really starts to matter a lot for you. And I'm just really happy this one worked out. I think I've already won, really, you know, before you even get into what's in this.
Well, yeah, I mean, let's talk about it. So Bennett, I want you to start this one out as usual. You have some high quality questions when it comes to the intricacies of legislation like this. So go ahead and start us, please.
Well, I mean, I think the easiest place for us to start here would just be for Rohan. Can you just give a brief introduction to the objectives of the eCash bill?
Yeah, sure. So the overarching objective is to develop a publicly issued digital dollar that replicates and maintains the privacy, anonymity, and decentralized processing features of physical cash to the greatest degree possible. So we designed the bill to be centered around the Treasury rather than the Fed. So it's explicitly and intentionally not a CBDC. The word CBDC doesn't tell you really anything other than it's issued by the central bank. And if there's one thing that this is not, it's issued by the central bank. But in contrast to most traditional banking technologies that rely on a central banking intermediary or rely on a commercial bank intermediary, and then that whole network has a central bank on the back end, or in contrast to a lot of crypto assets that use a blockchain or a distributed ledger, this involves no ledger whatsoever. So just like physical cash, you issue the token, it gets stored in a physical instrument or a device, and you make transfers by simply changing possession or moving things between those devices rather than changing ledger-based balances.
One thing you mentioned there is that it was very explicitly being issued by the Treasury and not by the Fed. And so I was really curious when I was reading the bill why that was the choice, why the Treasury instead of the Fed.
Yeah, why are you using this language?
Well, if you know, I think one of the problems is that we've had this discourse now for going on, I don't know, a decade, maybe a bit longer, about government digital currencies, sort of almost around the same time as Bitcoin. People started to really seriously talk about the government issuing their own digital currency. But that at this point, at least, that discourse has almost become completely centered around models and technologies and approaches where the central bank is the central actor. In fact, you know, the Biden executive order that just came out around crypto uses the term CBDC almost interchangeably with a digital dollar. And as I said before, that term doesn't actually tell you anything. It doesn't tell you why it's issued. It doesn't tell you how it's designed. It doesn't tell you who is going to use it. The only thing it tells you is that it's issued by the central bank, which if you're a central banker is great for you because you control the whole process, right? You say, I don't know what it's going to look like. I haven't decided that yet. We're still looking at options. But the one thing we're sure of is we're in charge. Like, it's going to be us who's going to be in the driver's seat. But, and this is where I have a problem with that, is that in the very next breath, the very next thing that comes out in those debates or those conversations is the central bankers say, well, of course, we don't provide retail services. Well, of course, we would have to make sure that anything we did had the same know your customer and anti-money laundering rules that apply to every other account that we offer. Of course, we probably want a two-tier system where our existing intermediaries provide the last mile services. So suddenly, what started off as just a, well, we should be in charge, becomes actual constraint parameters on the design and the function. And if you look at physical cash, it actually has very little to do with a bank account. It doesn't have a ledger. As I said, it uses hardware rather than sort of quote unquote software as its baseline kind of method of validating transactions and validating people's claims on account balances. And perhaps most importantly, in the US context, the Fed does not issue any form of token. Federal Reserve notes in our pocket, they have the Federal Reserve's name on them, but they're printed by the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, which is in the Treasury. And coins that we use every day are issued by the Mint, which is again in the Treasury. And when you have your stimulus cards sent out, they are sent out from the Bureau of the Fiscal Service in the Treasury. So if you were going to start from an objective point of view, if you hadn't had your brain worms from the Fed CBDC discourse, and you were going to say, we want to issue a hardware secured token-based form of money that goes to retail actors and can be held directly by them, which government agency is the one to do that? The answer is the Treasury.
But so you essentially are saying that you see the central bank as swaying too much power, if you are to use that terminology. And so by explicitly using the terminology that you're using, the context that you're using, and the language that you're using, it's to avoid that and rely on the Treasury, which is not as I guess I'm wondering, what's the difference there between the Treasury and the central bankers?
Well, yeah. So the first thing is, as I was just saying, you know, horses for courses. This is designed to be pluralistic. It's not in competition with a CBDC. It's not in instead of a CBDC. You want a Fed account, which I support, you have it. You want postal banking, which I support, you have it. What this does is say, we've always had different forms of money. We've had accounts and tokens for 5,000 years. We don't need to choose between them. In fact, we should be doing the opposite and making sure that a digital dollar has every option available so that individual groups with different needs, different values, different priorities will feel like there's a form of a digital dollar for them. Most people in their wallets have a credit card, a debit card, and maybe some physical cash, depending on, you know, how much in the future you live. And so this is really an attempt to slot into that final category. It's to say that this has all of the benefits of cash, privacy, anonymity. You don't need a third party to approve your payments. But it's also got the risks of cash, which is if you lose your wallet, you lose your device, you lose the money. So people aren't going to be wholesale leaving the banking system for this, but they are going to be using it the way that we use cash today. Now, so that's the sort of why does this fit in with the cash instruments rather than the account. Now, from a political point of view, yeah, first of all, central bankers are bankers. You know, I've been making this joke all around the way, but you ask a bunch of bankers what they think technology can do, they'll say a better bank account, right? You know, this is the old line that's attributed to Henry Ford. He said, if I asked the public what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse. Well, central bankers, you know, there is more in heaven and earth than there is in central bankers' philosophy when it comes to digital money. And there's a reason why central banks around the world haven't really paid much attention to this. And that's because it's grounded in values different from the ones that they have. Central bankers love data. They love analyzing data. They are firmly embedded in the AML KYC regime that applies to accounts that says you have to have identities because you as an account manager have responsibilities to third party actors. And those third parties do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy because they're sharing their information with you as a third party. So they're coming from a world where they're applying the legal framework, they're applying the technical framework of accounts. And that's fine for account money, but if we want to do something different, they're the wrong people to ask. They're also not going to be committed to it. So if a spook or a cop comes to them and says, we need a back door, do you think that Chair Powell is going to stand up and fight for civil liberties? He's sort of secretly been an ACLU plant this entire time. I mean, I'm not convinced. So, you know, the question of who's actually going to support this, well, I'm not convinced that, you know, former Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen, now Secretary Treasury Janet Yellen, is going to be particularly interested either. But the thing about the Treasury is it works under the pleasure of the president, and the president's politically accountable. So this is a way to say this is a debate that should be being had in public, behind, you know, in front of everybody in the town hall. If you don't like it, you have a right to have a voice. This isn't some technocratic central banker. It's all independent. If you want to even have anything to do with it, you're undermining central bank independence. All that stuff is irrelevant, and we're cutting it out from minute one in the conversation.
That was one of the really exciting things for me when I was reading the bill, is because unlike the CBDC proposals, which I've read, which almost entirely focus on like settlement between the banks and stuff like that, because that's what the Fed's doing all the time.
Yeah, they don't even want to provide a regular bank account. They're really wanting to only do wholesale banking. That's the only thing they really feel comfortable with. Yeah.
And this was so clearly focused on the end user and trying to emulate as much as possible the cash-like experience for that end user. Do you think you can speak a little bit to how a system like this would actually work? Because like what we've established so far is that it involves these secure devices. It does not use a distributed ledger like a blockchain, and that it can be used offline. And that's a challenging set of requirements.
Yeah, it's utopian. It also makes little ponies and just gives them out to people every day. So the first thing is that, and this is a really important point for crypto advocates, I think, to understand, which is the conversation around how to design an effective decentralized crypto instrument is trying to solve two problems. The first problem is the decentralized payments, settlement, storage, your standard payments technology stuff. The second problem, however, is monetary theory, monetary policy, how much to issue, to who to give it to, under what conditions. And the thing that Bitcoin and others have done is they've combined those two. They've said, we need a system where we don't trust any one person, not only to process transactions, but also to determine how much to issue. Now, if you're a person that doesn't believe in democratic public money, okay, you probably won't like a version of a digital public dollar. But if you accept that public money has a place, it will continue to have a place, and that public cash is actually probably an important thing to preserve, even if you don't like it, but only because if you want private monies to have privacy, you probably need to convince people that it's worth having privacy and money in general. And most people are going to experience that with public money first. So if we lose the battle over public cash, my view is we're going to lose the battle over any privacy in crypto as well. So even if you don't want to use it, even if you don't like it, you probably want this thing to exist and be legal so that there's some cover for the things that you want to be legal too. But the problem is that because in the 90s, when we were last seriously talking about hardware secured options, and that was, you know, before cell phones, before Web 2.0, all that stuff, it was back when the only option was prepaid cards. And there was serious efforts around that. The Bank of Finland did the Avant card. In England, they had the Mondex card. In Canada, in the early 2000s, they had Mint chip card.
What happened to those?
Well, a lot of them failed because governments weren't really interested at the time. And then 9/11 happened, and then the idea of having any privacy went out the window for 20 years. So it was a moment where a lot of crypto advocates said, well, nobody's picking up what we're putting down, so we're going to move into a system where we only use software and we're going to issue a private money. And so they're solving two technical problems or trying to at the same time, and it leads you to stuff like proof of work or proof of stake and all of these questions, which are very complicated. But if you have centralized issuance, which public money already does, then all you need to solve for is the decentralized payments. And that's a lot easier because you can do a lot of the initial security and counterfeiting protection at the point of issuance, and then all you're doing is transferring that secured instrument between actors. Whereas with crypto, you have to solve the problem of how to issue it as well in an untrustworthy way. But to go to the question of how it works, there would be some sort of offline or air-gapped or something like that at the central bank, at the treasury. They would mint these in the same way as they mint coins and notes. They would ship them out. You would buy a prepaid card, or you would go to a bank and you would basically make the equivalent of withdrawal, or you could even do it on an app on your phone. You would withdraw the money from your bank account. It would be the equivalent of the bank buying pallets of physical currency. They would buy it with their reserves at the central bank, and that would be uploaded onto your device. And that device would have some sort of trusted executing environment or a physically unclonable function. And you would then be able to communicate with any other recognized hardware device that could include prepaid cards and other phones. And the idea would be you would essentially ask that device, you would do a handshake and say, hey, do you have this amount of money? They would say, yes. They might not tell you how much they have, but they would say, we have as much as you need. And they'd say, okay, I want you to send it to me. They put your signature, their signature in it, and it would go to the next device. And the original device would lose that signature. It would be destroyed, and there would be a new signature that would come in that would be whatever the new balance is on that instrument. So if you try to spend it to somewhere else, it wouldn't exist anymore. It would show that other buck, you know, equivalent value was no longer valid. Now, that's not perfectly secure. You can always crack hardware just like you can crack any system, but there are two considerations there. One is we would put denominational caps on these devices, maybe like 10,000. I didn't put a specific number in the bill because we didn't want that to be the fight in day one. That's going to be a political question, but I will say, you know, as high as possible. And so even if you do hack an individual device, you're maybe getting $5,000, $10,000. You're not getting $100 billion. So if you want to be transferring, you know, Pablo Escobar level money, you're still going to be having duffel bags worth of stuff. It'll just be duffel bags worth of prepaid cards or cell phones rather than of paper money. But the other aspect is that the individual hardware devices themselves are going to be something that you could separately from the transaction validate. So there could be little kiosks all over the place. You tap the phone to see if any balances, and they could do a check with an existing list of kind of legitimate dollars. So just like with physical currency, someone pays you a $100 bill, you put it up to the light, you run a pen over it, you have a black light. Nowadays, there are, you know, all sorts of devices that can validate. You could have a system or an easy device that could validate that the funds you're receiving are, you know, still authorized. But that would be a separate process to the transaction. You wouldn't be having to get, you know, third party Uncle Sam or a bank's green light to actually process the transaction itself. And any record of all of that stuff would exist only on the device. It wouldn't be, there wouldn't be some place in the cloud, you know?
It's very interesting to me because you have essentially answered one of my questions, which was, while I can understand that maybe the transactions are private, it appears as though any physical, whether it's a card or a physical hardware wallet or whatever you want to call it, right, that will have traceability, right? And I guess maybe there might be some concern about that. Like, I guess I have a $20 bill right here. There's a serial number on it, so it is identifiable, obviously. But what I can do with this $20 bill now that it is in my wallet, whether I'm KYC'd or AML'd or whatever at a bank, is I can take this $20 bill and, for instance, pay an illegal immigrant to do something, and that doesn't have to be traced, and that illegal immigrant now has that dollar and or that $20 bill, and they can use it as they see fit. It doesn't seem like there's room for that kind of a transaction in the eCash Act. Is that incorrect?
No,
am I missing?
No, there absolutely is, because you buy the device, right? But you don't have to give AML and KYC when you buy the device. There might be certain intermediaries that will ask for that, but I could imagine this being available at a convenience store next to the transit cards. You could buy this at the postal service next to the prepaid debit cards that they sell where you don't ask for permission. You could buy a prepaid phone and it would have this built into the phone functionality, and you know, you could buy the phone. The other thing is, you know, just because the initial dollars have to be just because certain intermediaries might charge KYC rules, once you have one of these devices, the dollars that get sent to that device don't have any KYC. So you could get $100 from your bank account. The bank would know you withdrew $100. But if you give it to me, there's no record that the $100 on my eCash account came from yours per se. So, you know, you use barcodes there, but coins don't have a barcode. Coins are the most private form of public money, also issued by the Treasury, and they don't have any barcode whatsoever. So there is no record of who owned a coin before you did, and there's no record of every person who's ever owned a banknote except at the point of issuance and the point of redemption again. But if you had intermediaries who, you know, provided this as a service, you could come in with physical cash, give it to them, and they'd give you a card, and that would be it. Now, that doesn't prevent other forms of good old-fashioned gumshoe detective work. You know, there's still surveillance cameras everywhere. Your phone's still got a million other surveillance devices on it. If somebody, you know, hacks your phone and is logging every keystroke, you're still going to be screwed. But it does mean that the money itself is dumb. You know, it's a dumb instrument. It's not calling to central command, and it's not something where you have to have an identity to use it, because that would defeat the point of it, frankly. You know, this is one of the things we've seen with those prepaid cards that the government sends out and things, which is a lot of people don't trust them, A, because they're going to charge fees, and B, because, you know, if you're undocumented or if you're a sex worker or something, they're going to try to stop you from using it. But being able to use your money however you want, I think, is a pretty quintessential American value. And dare I say it, is probably one of the best things about living under capitalism, is it's that whole pretty woman idea. You know, my money is good as yours. If I can, you know, on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog. Well, if I want to pay for something on the internet, then hopefully nobody will deny it to me because of my race or gender or sexual preference or political beliefs as long as my money's good. And I think this is an attempt to preserve that feature as much as possible.
I remember when you came on here before for episode 16 to talk about the Stable Act, you drew up like a quadrant of like public money versus private money and then privacy respecting money versus non-privacy respecting money. And like at the time you said the goal would be to try to get something in the quadrant of both publicly guaranteed and privacy respecting. And so, well, congratulations.
Should have said same in 6 months.
Congratulations on getting that bill introduced.
And you were quite down on it at that point, if I remember correctly. I think you did not think that that was even a real possibility at the time.
Yeah, I mean, all power to Congressman Lynch, who really took a leap of faith on this one. I mean, he's no radical progressive. He's a moderate. And of course, we had Rashida Tlaib, who came out with the ABC Act, which sort of pointed in this direction with a sense of Congress. But it was a relatively short and brief. And this is really, you know, a chance to write the whole thing the best way that we could. And the congressman has been absolutely 100% supportive all along the way. We just had the ACLU's senior political strategist come out and say that if we're going to issue a digital dollar, it should be this kind. Jerry Brito from Coin Center said, I'm not sure if we should issue a digital dollar, but if we should, the eCash Act is the best version I've seen. People like Stephen Deal and Isabella Kaminska, who've been very critical of both crypto on one hand and of CBDCs on the other and their surveillance capacity, say, look, this looks legit. It checks out. So I think, you know, I'm not saying we did it perfectly, but I think as far as an initial kind of salvo into this debate, hopefully now finally there is a perspective in that kind of, you know, pro-privacy, pro-public quadrant. And the fact that we've had the reaction we've had, you know, the Wired magazine article on this was really, really fantastic, I think just shows how missing this perspective has been in the debate so far. It's been crypto advocates saying, you know, why do you hate freedom? And then public money advocates saying, you know, why do you think that capitalism is good for the average person? And they've been talking past each other. And it's possible to believe in public goods and believe in privacy. And now we finally have a kind of lodestar for what that would look like in this conversation.
Can you, one of the questions that I have is about the privacy board. Can you kind of go over the privacy board? Because it's just, one, it's an interesting concept, but two, I'd be interested to see how well that works in reality versus how it looks on paper.
Yeah, I mean, look, we didn't give them the power to sort of override with a supermajority vote the whims of the Treasury or anything. This is really about the transparency side. You know, I think a lot of people say, do you really trust the government to do this? You know, and of course I don't trust the government to do this. I don't trust the government to anything. That's not why you have a government. You demand things of it and you hold it accountable. That's how power works. But, you know, it's the same government that lies about FISA courts and mass surveillance. Of course, I'm not going to just take them at their word. But part of the thing to do here is to give privacy advocates a foothold in the institution. And so those independent privacy board members have a term that they can't be removed except, you know, by the president. They have to give a report about it. But also they have access to all the internal materials. They can write on the official letterhead with budgets that they can control individually as well as collectively, separate from the Treasury. And my hope would be that the appointment of people to those positions would be something that privacy advocates would take very seriously. You know, if you're a lawyer, you care who gets on the Supreme Court. If you're an economist, you care who gets on the Fed board. If you're a pro-privacy person, hopefully you'll care who gets on this committee. And if it turns out that they're lying and they're putting backdoors into things and all that kind of stuff, I would want those members of the committee to blow the whistle and for people to use that as a red flag to mobilize. Not because I think that that's enough, but because I think that's one of the ways that you can get a kind of temperature check about whether this thing is going off the rails from what it's supposed to be versus what it's actually doing.
Returning to before, when we were talking about kind of the different types of money, if this were to get passed and become a thing that was relatively broadly used, like beyond the pilot phase of this, what effect do you think it would have on some of the other existing forms of money? So like both the kind of pseudo-private money of the money transmitters like Venmo and the more outright private money of like the stable coins, and then just payments processors like Visa and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, right now, I think a lot of financial institutions hate cash for two reasons. One is it's hard to profit off it, and B, they can't gather data of it. So there's very little to offer a private for-profit actor for sort of being involved in this public service. It's almost like an easement. You know, you don't really like the fact that your house has a pathway to the beach that other people use, but you really can't find an explanation for why they shouldn't be allowed to access the beach. So I guess, you know, I have to let them walk on my land. You know, it's sort of like that, I think. The banks know that they can't really say that people shouldn't be able to access cash, but if they could, they would. So in one respect, I think that the war against cash, which has been waged for many years now by banks, by fintech companies, by data companies, and by governments, is hard to win in part because cash just looks like it's quaint. It looks like it's old. It looks like it's in the past. I think it's really important, but this allows us to keep the spirit of cash on both sides of the digital divide. If you believe in cash as a concept, you can support physical cash and this. So, for example, the law that was just passed in Philadelphia requiring merchants to accept physical cash. They can't go cashless, because that was causing severe financial inclusion concerns, for example. Or when people say they made up about cash being a vector for COVID. You know, the World Health Organization said there was no evidence that cash was actually a vector for COVID, but it was a good narrative that cash is dirty, we're going to go cashless. Well, if you had to switch to digital cash for a while, you could still have all the benefits of privacy, even if we're having the debate about the cleanliness, rather than saying, oh, cash is dirty, I guess we all go into surveillance money now. But to the private question you're talking about, I think, first of all, it will make a lot of money transmitters maybe less attractive by comparison. What is Venmo offering? I mean, I guess you get the option to share with your friends when you pay someone something, which I cannot believe people actually enjoy, but apparently some people do. So maybe they'll still want to have their money surveilled. It's just cash plus taking a photo of it and putting it on the internet or something. But then when it comes to something like stablecoins, you know, on one hand, a lot of people are using stablecoins because it's the only kind of money-like, you know, public money-like instrument they can use in certain contexts. So if you can use an actual digital cash instrument, I think it'll take the wind out of the sails of the stablecoin industry to a large degree. But also, to the extent that there are laws prohibiting people from engaging in illicit activity, and that stablecoins allow you to get around those jurisdictional laws in your jurisdiction, physical cash already does that as well. There are whole countries that use the US dollar as their primary medium, and that would be something they could do as well. So I think certainly it allows you to do money transmission in a cleaner, crisper way. And to give one basic example of that, in the COVID relief, we proposed using prepaid debit cards to get to people who didn't have a bank account. Part of that was that we proposed to have an emergency responder corps that would go and knock on people's doors and actually put the money in their hands, because we recognized that it's not enough to just have a piece of technology. You actually have to get people to be able to use it. That was the way that we dealt with the access problem. But the people who don't trust a banking system, a prepaid debit card is still connected to a bank account on the back end. It's just a numbered account but they can be shut down. That can keep a record of all your transactions, all of that kind of stuff. If you wanted to donate it to political dissidents with your prepaid debit card and the government wanted to prosecute for that, they could find that information at that bank account. So this is an attempt to really do what prepaid debit cards do, what a Venmo balance does, but better. But the way that it should work, which is actually cash-like, not account-like. That said, there are reasons why, as I mentioned before, you might want to not put all your money in this because it's risky. You are taking on all the risk yourself, just like most people don't want to run their own email server. Because even though you can do that, it comes with additional complications. So I think that this is not going to get rid of intermediated money in general, but it is going to take a chunk out of them for the purposes that they are currently using that as the nearest approximation to cash. This will be a much better approximation of cash, and the people for whom that's their primary goal will be likely to use this instead.
The timeline for this seems either incredibly optimistic, or maybe I'm not giving the government enough credit. But I even for pilot programs, like I'm seeing 90 days after passage, 180 days after passage, and I'm thinking to myself, like, and I understand there's exceptions for certain measures and stuff, but it just feels incredibly optimistic. I'm wondering if the reason for that, though, is because you do feel as though Bitcoin, stablecoins, anti-government sentiment, anti-US dollar sentiment, anti-cash sentiment is getting stronger and stronger, or if it's just like a basic thing that you're just throwing in the law, like that any law has to have.
I think historically all good protests have the word now at the end of all of their posters when they're having demands. And I think, you know, justice delayed is justice denied. And frankly, when it comes to putting a particular number in, we were always going to be, if it was 5 years, people would say, well, 5 years is infinity in digital terms, right? So we put it in to be 2 years and that kind of thing. And I think that's still a pretty long time. And of course, you know, I'm an academic. You say you'll deliver something in 3 weeks, you deliver it in 6 months. So I don't expect them to necessarily keep to these timelines, but you have to set an initial expectation for them to fail to meet in some sense. But I think the reality is that, yeah, this is a fast-paced area where we do have to move quickly. The good news is, and this is one of the reasons I felt comfortable putting those timelines in, is that there are technologies out there. There are vendors, there are people working on this kind of stuff who can get started with proofs of concept and that kind of thing. And, you know, my hope is that it'll take a while for this bill to get passed, right? That doesn't happen overnight if it's going to happen at all. In the meantime, the fact that this is even being discussed, the reaction that's being received, my hope is that it will be a kind of green light to technologists that this is an area they should be spending more attention on than they have been up until now. I mean, when's the last time you heard about any digital money project that didn't involve a bloody blockchain? And now people who may be interested in that kind of technology might know that there are sort of actual interested parties on the other side who might want to buy what they come up with and use it. So this could take 6, 12 months, 18 months to pass, and that gives people a time to do the development of the tech. But also there are companies that have already tested this in other countries. We've had prepaid cards for a long time. There are hardware-based trusted executing environments on phones that, you know, Google and Visa and others have already been looking at. So I don't think that when it comes to testing this stuff, we're sort of starting completely from scratch. It's more a matter of show us what you've got, and we'll look at them all and then make a decision. It's really more about kind of playing the field of vendors than it is about needing to actually test the technology from day one.
Right. I mean, I don't think that there's any kind of issue. Maybe there is in America. I don't know how technologically advanced we are when it comes to payment systems through phones and stuff. But I do know from my time in China when I was there in like 2018, 2019, they know you're a tourist. It's not about like the way you look. They know you're a tourist if you use cash. That's how they can tell. That's how they can tell what's going on. That's how they know if you don't have a Chinese bank account and if you're not used to being there. You could speak perfect Mandarin, and if you pull out cash, they're like, oh, where are you actually from? So I wonder if you are, because that is as tracked as you can probably get, is like a Chinese issued telephone with money on it from your Chinese bank account. I mean, I'm sure the Chinese Communist Party is paying attention to every single transaction.
Yeah, look, I assume don't give the NSA short shrift. They're doing their very best as well. So,
so do you think? I guess that's my where I'm coming from here is like as quick as this could be implemented. I assume you want to take more time because you want to make sure that that isn't the implementation, right?
Yeah, so we directed the bill to use open source software and hardware wherever possible, and I think that's going to be a huge part of the transparency along with the Monetary Privacy Board. If it's all behind closed doors, I think there's a very real risk it falls the way of Mint Chip, which was the Canadian Mint's attempt to do a hardware secure digital dollar in the early 2000s, and they used proprietary hardware, and there was too many risks associated with it. But and this is sort of deeply ironic, I think, but China actually has a reloadable stored value card version of its digital yuan that actually does work offline and is anonymous in very small denominations. Now, I don't know if I trust it. It's certainly not open source, and I don't know if I consider the denominational caps they have to be sufficient. But God forbid that they outrun us on privacy and anonymity, and that ends up becoming better than the US dollar. I mean, you know, the US dollar abroad is a sort of as potent a symbol of American capitalism as there is, and if we don't have a digital dollar, you know, out there, then it's going to completely disrupt how people use the American dollar. So unless someone's saying tomorrow we should try to, you know, de-dollarize every country that's ever used physical US currency, which I don't think anyone actually wants, even if they might say they do for optical purposes, we are going to want something that can be held by average people that easily. Now, as I said, I don't think the technology is actually super hard to develop, but making it transparent and clear is definitely going to be important. So I, you know, would say the next step for people on the tech side who are interested is start you know, trying to work with people who have access to white label prepaid card technology, et cetera, and start getting some stuff out there that's open hardware specs that you could, you know, manufacture at multiple places. So we're not going to be building tech that's dependent on one manufacturer, or that, you know, if there is a blob, to try to create an open source version of that particular part of the software, et cetera, as soon as possible. As I said, the timelines are not as important as the integrity of the project, obviously. But if we do leave this forever, it will be too late. And people will have become accustomed to using, you know, thank God it's not going to be bloody Facebook's currency, right? But we're waiting, right? We're waiting for the network effect to hit. We're waiting for everybody to go, well, I just use Venmo now, or I just use X now. And that to be the thing that 15 years from now just becomes synonymous with the act of paying. And we wanna make sure that it's not PayPal, it's not Venmo, and it's not some dangerous stable coin, and it's not a government surveillance coin. You know, of those options, I think it's much more likely that it's going to be some private sector one, because they're the ones that can move fast while everybody is jamming the public sector from being able to act. But look, six months is enough time to do all kinds of things. If you look at the 6 months after the Patriot Act, they built a surveillance state pretty damn quickly. So where there's a will, there's a way to act quickly. And, you know,
building that for a really long time, though. Give them credit there, too.
That's fair. They added an extension. You know, they added a whole level to the house. Yeah, that's right. They went on a spending spree.
Vertical integration.
Exactly. They went national. They were regional and they went national. But yeah, you know, if people said, look, the stakes are this big. The stakes are the future of privacy and transactional freedom. And we either go one way or we don't. And if we wait 3 years, we're fucked, frankly. So what do we do? You know, I didn't make the timeline. The timeline was there. That's just how fast this stuff moves. So either the government, you know, picks up the slack and makes it work, or it doesn't. But the good news is, and I had the opportunity to interview the former Mint director, Philip Deal, when we were talking about the $1 trillion coin proposal, but he was actually testifying in 1995 saying that the Mint should issue a stored value card to replicate the features of coins, saying we are the only entity in the government that cares about privacy. It should be us. And I mean, talk about back to the future, but he's the kind of visionary director of the Mint that got stuff done real quick. And I could imagine if we put the right person in charge of this program who really had an axe to grind or something to prove, and we gave them enough autonomy, that this timeline is doable.
I just quickly want to say that to Deal, that if he somehow hears this podcast, he got me into coins, and I am unfortunately still 100% neck deep into coins. I love the Canadian Mint and the U.S. Mint. I still have my first coin that I bought in 1999, and I have the sets from 1999 of the state quarters. I was obsessed.
He loves that program. He loves that program. Yeah, and he's an example of a bureaucrat who takes pride in making government work well. And we're so not used to seeing those kinds of people. We're used to seeing people that have got their, you know, their eyes on the watch, their one foot out the door, and they're waiting to take a paycheck from some private company on the other side. And their job is to stall bad regulation for business and to maybe do, you know, that old Kamala Harris joke, we're going to provide $10,000 of debt forgiveness to someone that sets up a small business in a disadvantaged community for 3 years or whatever bullshit. And the idea of just doing something big and simple and good and taking credit is just anathema. But those people exist. We just have to empower them and put them in the right positions to actually do it.
Yeah. Well, he got a lifelong supporter out of me. All it took was some silly quarters with pretty pictures on them. I mean, I still talk about that.
Yeah. A Texas businessman is my favorite public policymaker in the monetary space. Go figure. Yeah.
Not what people would have predicted.
No, exactly. Anyway, the point is just if you ask someone like him, I don't imagine he'd say, "Oh, it's impossible, I can't do it." He'd say, "All right, I'll do my best. Let me get back to you if I need a little bit more time, but you know, we'll put pedal to the metal." And that's the mentality we need. You know, these crypto people who say, "Well, what do you expect? Government can't do anything." And then they turn around and then they get upset that the government is corrupt and doesn't do anything. It's like, "Yes, you get the government that you expect. Have higher expectations, you know? My kindergarten teacher had high expectations."
They also get mad when the government does do things.
That's right. The regulatory clarity, the regulatory clarity that we wanted was not the regulatory clarity we got. That was a huge mistake. You know,
Exactly. I regret asking. That was a mistake. Yeah. One of the requirements in the bill is that the eCash be interoperable with the with existing financial institutions. Is that just in the sense like you can go to your bank and deposit cash? So if you go to your bank, you can deposit eCash, or is it like a deeper integration than that?
Deeper integration, but definitely that's a part of it. The other part is thinking about things like future point of sale devices. We don't want people to be developing future point of sale devices that explicitly exclude this option from being able to be used. And the same would be, for example, if you're going to develop a phone and create a secure enclave on the phone for private currency to make sure it has that option. But basically the idea is that we want to make sure that you know, you go to a store or something and it's credit, checking, or eCash. We want that to be the choice. We want that to be the normalized choice. And the other part of it is when you force the businesses to do that, then businesses can turn around to the government and say, you're not providing enough support. You forced me to do that. So to give an example, in Australia, we have compulsory voting. And it's not like you get locked up. You know, you pay a $70 fine or you write a letter saying, I'm sorry, I was busy. I was on the toilet that day and didn't get to the voting booth. They're like, oh, that's fine. You know, they're very lax about actually enforcing your non-voting. But the point of it is to set the expectation that you're going to vote. And then also, this is, I think, the secondary point that a lot of Americans don't think about because they're just thinking about it in terms of like individual coercion, is that you then have to actually make accommodations on the public policy side so that people can vote. You can't force them to vote or say they have to vote and then not provide that accommodation. So we have a public holiday on election day. We have mandated time away from your employer, et cetera, et cetera. So if we have a system that says you have to accept eCash interoperably, then the government then also has a duty to facilitate that interoperability. And that keeps the affirmative responsibility on those with the power to actually change things.
It's funny because it's reminding me of like actual important moments in American history.
Yeah, like Lincoln with the greenback, like, you know, like FDR floating the dollar, like, you know,
it doesn't even have to be a, like a financial thing. I'm even thinking about like other moments in like whether it's fighting, essentially what you're fighting for is privacy in a new age, and I think that is a valiant effort, and you're fighting for it in a public way as opposed to a private way.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the debates around, you know, should we even have cash at all? What if people use cash for bad things? Are the same debates we had about the internet itself, you know, aren't we going to use the internet? And frankly, it's the same debates we had back in the Enlightenment about whether or not people should be able to read and have a piece of paper that they can access to, right? And so I think it really is that fundamental. And one of the things that's interesting is that this is very much picking up a conversation that really trailed off in the late 90s. But the reason that it trailed off there was the Patriot Act, was these other things, but also that was the last time we were talking about sort of the bare bones of the internet and what we want it to look like. It was the Telecommunications Act of 96, et cetera. And I think one of the things that we failed there was we failed to ensure that the finance layer was consistent with the principles of an open internet. So you can create, you know, peer-to-peer nodes, all that stuff. But if you have to pay because everyone's lives is material, right? Even businesses, even websites have to pay for the electricity. If you have to pay money to run your internet thing, then if the money is centralized, then that's where they'll get you. And I think this was a huge failure of the internet freedom movement to not put cash sort of front and center as a policy priority. And then when they did fail to convince governments in the 90s, the fact that they kind of turned to private monies, I think, was a huge error. What we needed was, you know, more mass mobilization. The cypherpunks should have allied with progressives and labor unions and all those people that, God forbid, it's the messy politics that you can't fix by writing code in your bedroom. But it is what actually gets you things like a 40-hour work week or the right against self-incrimination or, you know, holds those bastard cops accountable when they beat people to death. That's what actually changes things is mass politics. And this is an attempt to bring monetary privacy, you know, into a realm of mass politics and away from a realm of financial grifters and libertarians who think they're freedom fighters.
I will say that this is the only piece of legislation I've read while reading it where I got like actually excited because it is like such an attempt to avoid the self-fulfilling prophecy of claiming government can't act, right? It's It's an attempt to do an important thing in a big way that can potentially help people. And clearly, like, written with care and with an understanding of what would be necessary to actually pull it off. And so, like, that's why I was extraordinarily gratified when I saw the open source parts of the bill, because I think if it had ended up being closed source, it would have been immediately DOA, because you can't actually believe in the privacy if you can't verify it, if no one can verify it, right? And so in order for it to truly be private, it had to be open. And it was just gratifying to see the members of the House who came forward to sponsor it, like, being willing to stand behind that principle.
Yeah, well, my old law professor, Evan Moglen, who helped draft the GPL license with Richard Stallman, you know, he'd probably yell at me and say, why didn't you call it free software? You know, open source is already a compromise. And I think he's right on that. But I think if I wrote the word free there, people would get very confused and think they meant free as in free beer, not free as in freedom. So, for those listening out there who are the kind of people that say it's GNU, not Linux, and it's free software, not open source, you're right. And I'm sorry. And, you know, I that's a legitimate criticism. But hopefully I pissed off the right people on the other side that you'll still consider me on team. So
right now I'm just thinking about Richard Stallman.
Yeah, you know, I have a lot of respect for the GNU Tala program, you know, which was an attempt to provide a kind of, you know, free software answer to this. But they made a compromise with their technology that was asymmetrically anonymous. So it was anonymous for the payer, not for the payee. And the idea was that you would sort of still force merchants to have to record transactions so you could monitor it for tax purposes. And I understand that compromise, but with respect to them, this is where I think, you know, technologists playing monetary theorists is probably not, you know, I am willing to own cash being symmetrically anonymous and to say that lawyers can monitor and deal with the risks of tax fraud and things on the back end with other ways, and that it's more important at this stage to have a digital cash instrument that works like cash than it is to preemptively bake in compromises with tax collectors into that instrument. At this point, I consider this to be a kind of small C conservative defense of cash-like freedoms, and that what we want to do is preserve as many of them as possible. We're turning into a bend. We're doing a hard turn into the digital realm, and we're going to try and keep this car, like, within the lines of the road as much as possible. So maybe there'll be situations in the future, etc., where there might be additional things we need to think of. But at this point, the goal is to not let this transition destroy the privacy of cash. And if someone wants to make an argument for why we need to get rid of one little thing, fine, but they should be making that affirmatively and acknowledging that they're getting rid of something that we've enjoyed for thousands of years. I think the end of cash is the extreme radical position, not protecting it into the digital world.
That's something we were discussing like two episodes ago, and we had Josh Cincinnati on, is that cash is kind of like the only remaining broadly acceptable private currency, and that the further it gets pushed to the periphery, the more you have to accept that, like, your transactions end up being monitored. And the government, yes, ends up learning all that information about you, but so does the credit unions and the ad retargeting agencies and anyone else who can afford to buy it. And
that's right. And you're only as secure as the database the government has. And we've seen this already with Aadhaar. They say, first we'll get all of your data and somehow we'll store it securely. And you're like, well, I'm not sure about that side of things. And frankly, you know, it's like the, what is it, the Kobayashi Maru? The only way to win is not to play, right? The only way to win when it comes to safe data practices is to not collect any data unless you absolutely have to. And I think this is the only model that is really trying to embrace that principle of data minimization from day one.
What a way to end it with the way I remember it, a quote from War Games.
Maybe it's War Games. Thank you. I know. I think Kobayashi, you just have to be William Shatner and then you can win. But yeah, anyway, yes, War Games.
Yeah. But yeah, what a way to end it. I think that it makes sense that here we go. We're ending it with the War Games quote. But I hope that this gets some legs and, you know, makes it through. I mean, what are we talking good odds? What are you thinking?
Well, I think the national security state is a formidable enemy, and I think they're a formidable enemy within the Democratic Party as well as across the aisle. And I think, you know, there is a chance that this is going to have a cross-cutting coalition. You know, that people like Tom Emmer and Warren Davidson and Hollingsworth and others, I think, should in theory be supportive of this given their other statements. Now, I am long past being shocked if it turns out Republicans just hate government more than they like freedom and privacy. But at least given their statements now in opposition to a CBDC, the thing that they say they've wanted is exactly what we're trying to do with this bill. And that would hopefully be some cause for an alliance there. But I do see this, you know, cross cut a lot along different lines. I mean, we spoke to people at the ACLU and they haven't taken a position on money in years because they didn't really know what position to take. But the minute we propose this to them, they're like, oh, this makes a lot of sense. Thank you for doing this. And I don't know how many politicians want to get, you know, on the Democratic side, want to get on the wrong side of the ACLU. And as I said, Coin Center is out there saying, we're not sure we want any digital currency, but if government digital currency, but if we do have one, it should look like this. So compared to surveillance coin, you know, this is hopefully an option that actually has a legitimate interest base. Now, again, the forces on the other side are formidable. I would never claim they're not, but this isn't simply a kind of far left thing. It isn't simply a blue versus red thing. And it's not even really a top versus bottom thing in the sense that there are a lot of reasons why elites and others might want to care about this. There's, you know, the CIA was the one that invented Tor, for God's sake. So it's not that there aren't legitimate use cases for privacy amongst elites as well as the hoi polloi, but I think it is going to be interesting to see, you know, who ends up either thinking that it's more important to have, you know, the ability to catch the bad guys than to protect the good guys, one, and two, that they hate crypto so much that anything that sounds like it's sort of quote-unquote promoting dark money is too much of a handout to crypto, and they would rather kill cash if it means being able to kill crypto as well. I think those are going to be the coalitions in opposition to this. But hopefully, as I said, even some crypto people who might not care that much about public money can hold their nose and support this because it's part of a larger movement to protect values that they care about, and that protecting those values in general will have benefits for the things that they actually do care about.
Well, thank you for joining us, Rohan. What another educational and informative episode with you. And I hope everybody takes a look at the bill, the act, and decides how they feel about it and if they think they can make it better to voice that. But I appreciate it. And I think Bennett and I are both excited to see this and have you on. So thank you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Thanks, as always. Very thoughtful engagement. Appreciate it.
Another great episode of Crypto Critics Corner, this time featuring Rohan Gray. I want to thank you for listening. Hopefully you enjoyed it. Go ahead and hit the rating or review button on whatever podcasting platform you're listening on. And while I'm grateful that Bennett decided not to cancel the show, I do have to let you know that Bennett Tomlin decided to fire me, given my criminal background. So I guess this will be my last week with Crypto Critics Corner. You will be joined by Bennett Tomlin next week and a new host. Rumor has it that it's going to be Justin Sun. Thanks for listening for all this time, everyone. Sorry this is how it ends.